Put the fucking mic on.
How we doing, folks? It's your boy DB Barstool Sports starting nine, and you are listening to the End of the Bench. Scoot your ass down.
Today's guest is Ryan Rucco. Rucco is the podcast host for R2C2 with CeCe Sabathia on the Ringer Spotify network. We talk about that podcast in detail and jump from different media networks and seeing if it was stressful for CeCe and Ryan, because let's be honest, that can be a stressful situation, jumping from network to network. We also talked about Ryan's career broadcasting, yes, and ESPN covering all the NBA and focusing also on the Nets and the New York Yankees. We talked about Aaron Judge, MLB lockout, and the Harden-Ben Simmons trade, and a ton more in this awesome interview with Ryan Rucco. Let's get started right now. Today's guest is the podcast host of the R2C2 podcast under the Ringer Network with CeCe Sabathia. He's also the play-by-play man for the NBA and WNBA on ESPN, and also does a little of Nets and Yankees on the YES Network. It's Ryan Rucco. Ryan, thanks for coming on.
Appreciate you having me, man. Glad to be with you. Glad to see your Hakeem Knicks jersey standing proudly over your left shoulder there.
Yeah, I got that. Jeez, I might have been like 12 or 13. You did like all those autograph signings. I got that years ago. Been a Giants fan. But I do have to say a quick shout out right in the beginning is our friend, Justin Shackle. He was the one who set this up. Shout out to Shackle. And your guys' relationship goes way back.
Yeah, man. That's one of my best friends. Shaq and I went to college together at Fordham. My radio class, if you will, at WFUV consisted of some people who were in my grade, which was graduating class of 04, and then some who were graduating class of 05. Is that right? In college, or I have that 08, sorry. 08 and 09, not 04 and 05. I'm thinking high school. 08 and 09. I graduated in 08 and Shaq graduated in 09, but I transferred to Fordham when I was a sophomore from Loyola. And Shaq transferred, I think, after one semester at Quinnipiac his freshman year.
Right.
And then our other two super close friends there, Bobby Coyle and Lou Baricelli, they were in Shaq's grade. So Shaq came on, the three of us really connected quickly, Bobby, Lou, and I, and then Shaq joined us midway through my first year at WFUV, all of our first year at WFUV, Shaq's freshman year of college, my sophomore year of college, we just hit it off, man. And he's the best. He's just an amazing, amazing friend. Great dude. I'm glad to see him continuing to get more and more gigs because he deserves it. And he's just an amazing friend and one of my favorite people on the planet.
Yeah. Shackle's killing it now. He's got his new podcast, Towing the Slab with Coney on John Boy Media Network, which is great. I've never actually met Shackle in person, but we were friends. We became friends on Clubhouse. I hosted this MLB show on this club, and he popped in one day, and he was our Yankee guy. And we had like a Texas Rangers guy. We had Shackle. We had a bunch of other people that covered baseball across the country. And Shackle and I became friends. And that was led to you. And I also have to talk about, you are outside doing this podcast with me right now because you have COVID right now. How is that going? And then we'll get into how dealing with COVID in your job, because I'm sure it's not fun right now.
Yeah. Thankfully, my symptoms were mild and resolved quickly. So I am, if you can hear a little congestion still in me, but it's not as bad as it was, and it's not something that would make me lose sleep if I was on air with it. But otherwise, thankfully, I feel good, man. I had like a couple days where I felt a little under the weather, but I honestly, you know, and I was vaxxed and boosted, and my symptoms were super mild, gratefully. So it's really more so just the sort of tangible aspect of being sidelined from life while you wait for, you know, your quarantine period / returning negative tests, if you will, because I've been without symptoms for quite a few days, but I'm still just making sure I have negative rapid tests before I get back out in the world. And then navigating, trying to keep my wife and my 5.5-month-old daughter from, from getting COVID, you know? So far, thank God, knock on wood, they've come through okay. But yeah, exactly. It's, you know, the vaccine did its work, and gratefully I feel good. So yeah, the only thing is, like, rather than be inside spitting around my viral droplets, I take the podcast interview outside, because when I'm inside, I'm in a double KN95 situation still.
Well, you're doing the right thing, and I do appreciate you coming on, like I said before we even started, because look, not many people would with COVID. You are bedridden, you're chilling. You last thing you want to do is get on a podcast, but I appreciate you doing that. But during this whole COVID era in your career, you know, you're doing everything. The podcast, which we'll get into, you're calling a lot of net games, you've called Yankee games, and you're doing the NBA and WNBA for ESPN. How is the normal life of being in the booth and traveling and then going right into the COVID era of broadcasting, doing your career? How has that transition been? Has it been a struggle? And because you talked about it the other day on your podcast, you were like, you know, it's kind of nice not going and traveling. And that is like one benefit for this whole COVID era. But how has that affected you and your professional life?
Yeah, I think it's a balance, because the job is clearly better when you're on site, you know?
Sure, absolutely.
And anyone who says like, oh, we can do just as good a job not being there. No, you can't. Like, you cannot do just as good a job if you're not there. There are things you miss. There are things you can only experience there. So getting back on the road was super important to all of us this year, all of us at YES. ESPN has remained pretty committed to that throughout, you know, as much as they can throughout this, but certainly this year for all our NBA games and WNBA for the playoffs and ABC games, we would travel last year. And then for our women's college package, which is has a lot of like elevated production, we've been on the road. You know, there are certainly there were benefits to not traveling as much, because it gave me more time with my wife all during her pregnancy, and more time with my infant daughter. But for the job, you got to be there, and there's an energy that comes with being there. So
right, absolutely.
I think the most difficult part in the beginning, being back on the road, but during kind of COVID times, was so much of what makes the road feel like what it does is the camaraderie you feel with your teammates, you know? And so for us, we're all, you know, teams, just like, you know, the teams recovering, we're teams, you know, when it comes to our broadcast team.
Absolutely.
And so being able to go to dinner or grab a post game drink or whatever, or even have a production meeting, those are really key elements of what make a team when it comes to broadcasting. So it took a little while to get back in the flow where you weren't necessarily, you know, siloed in your room on the road. And I think that having some of that back, which I felt that with the WNBA playoffs some, and then some during the NBA, and I know I'm really going to feel it even more so after this, because I'm going to be the safest guy in the room right. You know, once I clear COVID protocols here. So I think it's important. You know, I think there's a lot of little intricacies that you get from that experience that you can only get by bonding. So it was kind of weird being on the road, but still feeling kind of sterile, like you're in sterile situations. And it's been nice to slowly get back to kind of, you know, integrating as, you know, as a team. And even just like being on the road with the Nets, being around the team, it's so important. The stuff you get informationally and just relationship wise by being on site, it's really invaluable. So it's slowly sort of been ramping up to feeling more and more like normal, which is nice.
Yeah, it's very important when you have these production meetings, because there is a feel to getting someone's, you know, point of view on a decision you want to, how you want to call the game or the pregame show or whatever it is. And to now kind of get back into the groove of things where you are on site in Brooklyn calling the net games with, you know, Richard Jefferson or whoever it is, the funny jokes or the conversations in person compared to doing it in your office back where you are is night and day for the viewer. Because if you say something, there's a delay, and you say you can call someone on the court wrong, and you might not know it, and whatever, it's a pain in the ass. And I feel bad for you and many other broadcasters have to go through that. And you mentioned on one of your episodes, you were like, yeah, you know, it was with John Boy, and you were on there talking about doing the broadcast, and you said, look, if I make a mistake when I'm not there, everyone's got to relax, you know, like calling not Carmelo Anthony, as you mentioned, or a different example. That just sucks though for like you, because you're like, you want to be a perfectionist. You want to do everything right. And I feel that sort of angle as a broadcaster on your side, because it's a pain in the ass. And like, I'm sure you had to deal with it.
Yeah. The toughest thing was, and the amazing thing was the technical crews that we have, in my experience, both at ESPN and Yes Network, they were unbelievable at giving us the highest quality show you could possibly have technologically within the constraints that we were given. But still, you know, I called all my NBA games last season until the second round of the playoffs from my apartment, looking at a monitor with the feed coming via Zoom. It's delayed.
Crazy.
So like, you know, they made the delay as small as possible. But for me, when I go back and I watch the game, I can't even really like get into any of my calls because I'm seeing the ball go through the hoop and then hearing the punctuation rather than it being simultaneous, you know, just that split second. For someone who it's, you know, for me, play by play is an art, that is, you know, that's troublesome. And it's just, you know, you're only going to achieve that by being there. You know, the atmosphere, the crowd, I think it was one thing when the stands were empty, it was a lot easier to do because you weren't missing anything atmosphere wise, even though you were missing things just visually being there. But once you have fans in the stands, you really had to be there to, you know, absorb everything going on. And I mean, there were times where, you know, I'm looking at a monitor and it's just different than when you're seeing bodies in front of you. And, you know, I had a Tennessee women's game on ABC in the first round of the playoffs last year in the NCAA tournament. And I kept on like two or three times, I mistook one player for another because they're kind of like their gait with their games was similar. And even though they didn't look alike necessarily, but when you're deciphering it off of an internet feed, it's easier to like, if you see kind of a similar gait in just the way they play, to mix it up. And it's like, you don't want to do that on a, you know, tournament game on ABC, you know, but it's just, you did the best you can. With those situations, it happened to me sometimes too. If you had, I feel like it happened with like Jokic and Isaiah Hartenstein at one point, where it was like they're both wearing number five, they're both tall white dudes,
and they're going fast too.
Yeah, and it's like, and it happens, you know. So I mean, you kind of just had to accept that like some things weren't going to be perfect, but you do the best you can. And you know, I think having genuine enthusiasm for the sport really helped, because it allowed me to manufacture the energy I needed, even when I was broadcasting from my apartment.
One benefit from the pandemic, in my eyes, is that podcasting, that world exploded. And one podcast in particular is yours with CC. I have his bobble hair, the lightsaber one. It was, I think it was May the 4th be with you that day. And it was CC. Yeah. So your podcast, R2C2, went from Uninterrupted to The Ringer. Talk about the transition from one big media company to the next. Was the process a little nerve-wracking of like, okay, so we're going to be on pause for a few months. We're going to lose maybe some listeners, and we don't know where our next home is. Talk about that transition, and were you in CC nervous?
No, I mean, I think that we knew where we were going when things ended with Uninterrupted. So we knew where we were landing. You know, first of all, I want to say, I loved the people at Uninterrupted. We work with some great people. Our producers who we work with locally, our board ops, our engineers, Mav Carter has always been great to me. So, you know, they're certainly, I think we could have had a wonderful future if we would have stayed there as well. But an opportunity came along at The Ringer, knowing the sort of audio infrastructure that existed there was really tempting. Plus on the heels of the Spotify Ringer deal that they did.
Right. It's huge.
You know, it kind of felt like an opportunity for us to take the pod to the next level and grow it even more with a place that really had established success with growing podcasts. I think, you know, one of the unfortunate parts you talk about, like taking an audience with you, is because we've been so nomadic, it has in some ways, you know, forced a lot of work from our audience. You know, we built up a nice following when we were at Players Tribune, then we left for Uninterrupted. We built up a really nice subscription, you know, subscriber base at Uninterrupted. We weren't able to secure the RSS feed, which was Uninterrupted's right. We went to the Ringer. We lose, you know, 5 digits worth of subscribers. Now we got to build them back up at the Ringer. There's sort of that, like, is it going to be Spotify or are you going to like be like, no, you can subscribe wherever. So I think that's the only tough part, is trying to find that, you know, not lose, you know, listeners in the shuffle, because we've made it hard on them. Gratefully, I feel like many of them have stayed, and this Judge episode is a great example of that. And I think one of the coolest things for Cece and me is, you know, obviously Cece and I both do other things. Cece's main job, as we all know, is being a Hall of Fame pitcher, right?
Right.
For me, you know, my main gig is being a play-by-play broadcaster for ESPN and the YES Network. But when I meet people, I would say 70% of the time, the first thing they bring up is R2-C2.
Isn't that incredible? Holy crap.
And Cece has the same experience, which is amazing, given the breadth of his career. Yeah, so, I mean, I think we find great satisfaction in that and in knowing that, you know, regardless of how we bounced around, people have stuck with it and really like to listen.
You know, it's interesting to see how, you know, we see the Ryan Rucco, the professional Ryan Rucco on TV all the time. And I'm not in any way saying you're less professional, but you kind of like let your hair down and be yourself, you know, and that's such a great, that is so important in podcasting now, because we want to see the real Cece. We see the Cece, you know, he's got everybody's back. He'll throw at anybody. You know, he's that guy, and we want to see more of that on the pod. And we're seeing it where he's talking, you know, he's talking back about Chris Russo and his opinions being the stupid old school, you know, baseball guy, or his passion about Otani, and you being able to joke around a lot, which I love. And I think that's why your podcast is so successful and all these great guests come on. I mean, the guest list is long and amazing. But there's one guy that you had on, was your boss, Bill Simmons. What is the relationship like with Simmons being a Boston guy and you two guys being New York guys?
Man, I think that makes for playful content when we talk, you know, Boston, right, New York sports. I have so much respect for Bill. I think if you look at what Bill has done in sports media,
crazy.
I mean, he's had a one of one career. You know, right. If you think about the place in sports media that he's carved out for himself, he literally blazed his own path and has had just remarkable success every step of the way. And so for me, I feel grateful to have been able to develop a little bit of a relationship with Bill, and then also to learn from Bill as well. And I, you know, I appreciate his wisdom and the way he sees things. And I just, he's someone I always liked, enjoyed. I was a fan of his work. I always admired him. And so to get to work for him in some sense has been a really big thrill for me in my career.
Do you guys see that the Ringer maybe gives a little bit more of creative freedom with your podcast and maybe Players Tribune and Uninterrupted? Because the Ringer has a wide range of podcast, sports, The Bachelor, you know, Succession, whatever it is.
But I think we've had a lot of creative freedom wherever we've gone. You know,
that's
I
great.
Would say if anything, we get more feedback at the Ringer than we have at the previous two places. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because Bill has incredible credentials and he's you know, very involved and aware. So I find it valuable. But I think that we've had, in general, creative freedom wherever we've been because, you know, people are enticed to us because of what we already have. And I also think there is an element of like, you know, CeCe's, you know, he's doing this the way he wants to do it, right? Like he's going to be open to suggestions and ideas, but if you come in and micromanage him, you know, he's going to be like, I don't need to do this, you know, like,
right.
and me to a lesser degree, I don't have the same money in the bank that CeCe does, but it's still not my main thing, right? Like right. I love right. it. And I think CeCe and I will do it forever. But you know, I think if someone came in and was like, you know, don't talk about this, do talk about this, don't talk about this, I think we'd be like, no, like, we're good. You know, we don't need to be doing this. Like, I think we both have the same ideas about what we want. You know, we had our initial conversation about the pod and, you know, how we wanted to start it, why we wanted to start it in spring training of 2017. It was about, like, I never wanted to go back to a place of feeling like a talk show host, which I did, you know, early on in my career at ESPN Radio New York, because I felt like, you know, there's just a certain culture of making mountains out of molehills. And I just didn't want to do that as somebody whose primary responsibility is a play-by-play broadcaster. I just didn't feel comfortable doing it. And I kind of got sucked into it, like that mode of doing things. And,
right.
and I kind of got to a place where I was like, if I ever do anything in hosting again, like I want it to be more personality driven, like story based, like getting to know guests, like, and CeCe had the same ideas. And so I think we kind of both like, yeah, we give our opinions about things, but I don't think we ever give them to get a reaction. We give our opinions because we have something to say, you know, like to your point about letting my hair down, like I can go into more depth on my podcast about why I think it's ridiculous Kyrie Irving isn't allowed to play at Barclays Center right now, right? Than I can yeah. in a game broadcast. Like I can just go into it more.
But you can't give your opinion, like your real, like passionate. I feel like you have to hold back a little bit professionally, but that's what's beautiful about podcasting.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. If I was on a game, I'm not going to be able to go all in on that. But on the podcast, I can. Now, I'm not doing that for any kind of reaction. I'm doing it because I have a platform and I'm right. educated on the issues and I feel comfortable articulating my educated point of view on it. Right.
Exactly.
But I don't ever feel like if somebody is like, you know, oh, who's going to win the NCAA tournament? Like you need to talk about this on air. I don't feel as compelled to like, I feel very comfortable being like, honestly, I have no idea. You know, I don't watch enough men's college basketball to have right. an informed opinion, you know? But so I feel like it's a good balance where, yeah, there are times CeCe and I have very opinionated things to say on the podcast, but it's totally organic. And there's nothing about the format that makes us feel compelled to go there unless we want to go there. Instead, what it's really about is, you know, having fun with the sports we love and getting to know figures in the sports. And we think we're able to do that better on R2C2 than other places because there's a level of comfort our guests feel because of, I think first and foremost, CeCe's credentials, his welcoming demeanor, his amazing personality. And then also I think the dynamic CeCe and I have kind of helps people let their guard down as well.
And that's what people come to the podcast for, is to get the real opinions that they're looking for. They can go on freaking ESPN or wherever to listen to a talking head. But if they want to listen to someone talk about a specific sport or a specific topic that everyone knows, you know, everything about, they'll come to you. And my last question when it comes to the guests and stuff like that, is there a guest you guys are looking for right now that is your white whale that the fans know that you want it and they want it too? Is there somebody that's on that list?
I mean, Eminem is my ultimate. I really,
really, why Eminem?
He's my favorite musician of all time. And CeCe is neighbors with his manager, Paul Rosenberg. So that's my that's my challenge for CeCe.
Okay.
My challenge for him is to get Eminem. I don't know how realistic that is. Someday getting Jordan on because CeCe's a Jordan brand guy. He's friends with MJ, so that would be amazing. I think somebody we're working on right now that we'd love to get on is Adam Silver. I know that's
what
we're working on.
That's huge.
Soon. We'll see if it happens. He's a busy guy, so if he can't, certainly will not hold it against him. He's an amazing man, and we would love it if it happens. We were working on doing a spring training trip and getting a few big names at spring training. It's on hold a little bit just because of the lockout. I think that we within baseball, one that like we've almost gotten a couple times that we want to make happen is Mike Trout. I know he's had interest, you know, we've had interest and we just haven't been able to make it work yet. I think there's, you know, I think it'd be really interesting at some point for us to do one with Cashman. We haven't, but I think it could be super interesting. You know,
you talk about how the relationship of how CC got persuaded to come to New York. And I didn't know CC's one goal was to be a Dodger. I never knew that until the other day when you guys were interviewing Judge and he said, yeah, when I became a free agent, I want to be in LA. I was looking at homes. Yeah. I was like, what? I thought it was New York all the way. See, that's the shit people like to hear. Firstly, for a guest, correct me if I'm wrong. I did my research, but if I'm wrong, let me know. A-Rod is my favorite player of all time. I wore 13 in college. I played college ball at Purchase. Batting stance was identical for me. If I had a guess for you guys to get is Rodriguez. If that's
So when we were at Players Tribune, we did have Alex on, and it was our first year, and he was amazing. We're due to have him back on for sure. I'm friends with Alex. CC's friends with Alex. We both love him. So I would love to get Alex back on, especially he's always got incredible things going on in his life. So would love that. Would love to get him back on at some point.
Okay. I want to get into nitty gritty of some New York sports and then we'll wrap up here. You had Judge on your podcast, which was the latest episode. You talked about, you guys went in detail that he's going to be a free agent next season. And, you know, New Yorkers are wondering, is Cashman the Yankees going to re-sign him? Will he become an unrestricted free agent and get a gigantic contract? Is he worth the money? Your opinion, will the Yankees sign him long-term at the age of 29?
Yeah, I have no insider knowledge, let me say that, because sometimes we can get ourselves in trouble because people just assume we do. I don't have any, and I'm not just being coy, I don't have any insider knowledge as to whether – you know, there are negotiations going on or they will be or there have been or whatever. But I do think ultimately, whether it happens before the season or after the season, he'll stay. I think that, you know, Brian Cashman's even said he's a special case, you know, and I think that, you know, he said that in reference to the idea of signing him before his contract expires, which is usually something the Yankees don't like to do. But, you know, I think that he's not just an incredibly impactful all-star MVP caliber player. He's also the kind of face of the franchise and leader you want if you're the New York Yankees, you know, and the guys who have that level of talent and also have that level of commitment and appreciation for the franchise and carry themselves with the class that Judge does, like, you know, they don't grow on trees and they're a very rare breed. They're a very rare breed. So I think Judge clearly wants to stay a Yankee. He'll do whatever he has to do business-wise ultimately, but he clearly wants to stay. And I think there's a lot of reasons beyond just the way Aaron impacts wins and losses, which is reason enough. But I think there's a lot of reasons even beyond that to think something gets done.
Is he worth a 8-year deal? Because, you know, for me as a outside perspective and as a person in the media myself and a giant Yankee fan, you know, he's worth the money, but is he worth a 8 to 10 year contract? I don't think he is, strictly for the fact of injuries. There's no, absolutely zero reason to doubt that he can't perform. This past season he went off, MVP candidate in his own right, but I would maybe give him a 6-year deal. Maybe at most a 7-year with an option, maybe. But if you were the option as Brian Cashman, what would you do? If you can give your opinion on that.
I mean, I would. I think that you have to look at those later years as a tax for what you're paying for in the early years. You know,
so I say that all the time.
Yeah, like so. I mean, we could say like, hey, I feel much more comfortable giving Aaron Judge a 6-year deal than I do an 8-year deal. Well, of course you do. Like you would with any athlete who's going to be, you know, 30 to 36 in those years, right? Than you right. than you would age 37 and 38. But the reality is someone's going to give him that, you know, because they want yeah. his ages 30 to 34 in their uniform.
Right.
So if that's what it may, you know, sometimes because of the security, guys will take one less year or two less years to lock it up before they get to free agency. So, you know, if the Yankees came with, you know, a per annum that really entices Aaron and it was only 6 years, well, maybe he would take that. I don't know. But I and that obviously would be a great, you know, scenario for the Yankees. But if it took, if keeping him means tacking on a year or two where you're like, eh, he may not be quite as productive, do I think that's worth it? I do. I do think it's worth it because I think that what you're getting from him in the front end of the deal is worth whatever tax you're going to pay on the back end.
I want to ask a quick question about the MLB lockout, and then we'll get into this James Harden tree, which you are directly involved with the Nets all the time. But the lockout, you and I and millions of other fans and people in the media are frustrated. We are tired of this BS back and forth affair. This whole week, they're meeting every day. How many games are we losing this year, on your opinion? And how bad is this going to be for baseball going forward in the future? Because to me, I think all the fans we gained last year, you're losing a bunch this year.
Well, I think that it depends. I don't think you're going to lose any if you miss spring training games. I think you're going to lose some if you miss regular season games. And I think that the way I felt all along is, you know, more important than what each side wants individually, I think they both need to have an understanding that collectively they can't miss regular season games. No. I'm sorry, but for us to have to get pom-poms out about, yay, the season's back on May 1st, that's maybe I'm going to be forced into doing that in some sense because of my jobs, but like it's going to feel it's going to feel gross. It's going to feel gross.
Yeah, I can't blame you.
Because here's the thing. 2 years ago, we had a completely altered season because of reasons outside of the control of baseball.
Yeah, can't do anything about it.
Right. Can't do anything about 2020. Okay, maybe you could have 70 games to 60, whatever. You couldn't do anything about it. It is what it is, right? Then last year, your season was still altered some because for half the year, you had many ballparks that weren't at full capacity, right? Like you still had different things that made it not a real season. Let's not forget when the Astros came to Yankee Stadium in May, it was only 10,000 fans, even if it sounded like 50, right? So it wasn't a full real season last year, even though at the end of the year it started to feel that way. It wasn't.
Yeah.
This year, there is nothing but self-inflicted wounds to keep you from having your first normal baseball season in 3 years. To not figure out a creative solution to get that done is an absolute crime. And I don't care. I don't care what the players want or what the owners want. I don't care because your job is to be able to communicate it in a way that comes up with a palatable solution. And I don't care if this guy's an idiot or this guy's dense or this guy's, you know, too stubborn. Your job is to find a way to get that person to understand. That's your job negotiating. If you don't do that job, you're failing, whether you're up on the player side or you're on the league side. And so I have no sympathy. I don't care. I don't care if the players think they're right. I don't care if the owners think they're right. I don't care who's right. There's only one thing that's right, and it's coming up with a solution that does not miss a single regular season game. And anything other than that, I think will be a failure that has consequences that extend far beyond what either side seems to realize right now. Maybe they do realize it. I hope they do. But I don't know if it's fully appreciated in the conversation that there's nothing individually either side can gain to me that's more important than the season starting on time for the collective health of the sport.
Mic drop. Ryan Rucco, mic drop. Dude, you were spot on. I totally agree. If you lose spring training games, whatever. That's not really for the fans. It's really for the guys to get ready. And if they're not practicing on their own right now, then there's a problem within its own. But if we lose games till May, of course we're losing millions of dollars, which is not the real important thing. The important thing is the fan base is this small already. you're going to make it this small, and trying to compete with the NBA and the NFL has always been a problem, and it will always be a problem, but this doesn't help. And with the emergence of like Ohtani last year and guys who had ridiculous seasons with, you know, you have all this hard work that they put in. So, and with social media wise, they did a great job last year too. And then you put all on the back burner. We can go on forever about this, but I do want to end with the James Harden trade. Harden and the Nets, a wishy-washy, awkward relationship over the last year and a half. He goes over to the 76ers with Paul Millsaps, and the Nets get Ben Simmons, Seth Curry, Andre Drummond, and two first-round selections. Who won the trade? I think, I think the Nets won the long-term with depth with Seth Curry and Andre Drummond and whatever Simmons comes back. But who do you think won the trade?
I don't think you ever know until things play out. You know, I think that you can easily make a case for either team. I think both teams are improved. You know, the 76ers didn't have Ben Simmons on the floor. You know, he was a literal zero for them this season. They're getting James Harden. Would you trade Seth Curry and Andre Drummond for the play of James Harden? Of course you would. So that's a big win for Philadelphia as far as this team goes this year. For the Nets, you know, one thing that was very clear, especially after the injury to Joe Harris and Kyrie's, you know, current part-time playing status, although hopefully that changes. Some other guys in and out of the lineup, but especially those two, is they needed more depth. You know, like they needed another shooter badly. And I think they also needed some length, some athleticism, some youth, some versatility. And so this trade served a lot of purposes for them. Plus, I think Ben Simmons is going to thrive around KD and Kyrie, in addition to the other Nets, shooters and who they have. So I think there's a lot to like for each team in this deal. I think you do it 10 out of 10 times if you're the Nets. I think you do it 10 out of 10 times if you're the Sixers. And I hope we get to see those teams meet in the playoffs. You know, James Harden last year seemed like a perfect fit in Brooklyn. When they, you know, were playing without Kyrie or playing without KD, he just kept leading them to wins. He was unbelievable. I can't tell you how many times Steve Nash told us, both publicly and privately, just how great James Harden was in the room, what a leader he was. Like, he seemed to be one of the future cornerstones of the franchise. But this year, it was just different. You know, I think, we only saw the best version of him in spurts. And he didn't also have Kyrie there for huge chunks of time. So, I think it was clear that it was time to move on for both parties. And I think, given that, I think the Nets did about as well as you could have hoped for when you have to trade a guy like James Harden.
Let's just hope we see this next big three for more than 16 games, because I feel like we lost out on something great with those, with Harden, Kyrie, and KD. The talent there, only 16 games on the floor together, was a shame. But Ryan, I appreciate you coming on. Plug the podcast, your socials, whatever it is. This is your time. You're on the floor.
Hey, thanks, man. Yeah, you guys definitely follow our new YouTube page for R2C2. It's just R2C2 on YouTube. My Twitter is @RyanRuko. My Instagram's @RyRukes, RyRukes. And keep tuning into Nets on Yes, and to make sure to check out the women's NCAA tournament. I'll be doing that this year for the second straight year. It's as fun as any event I've ever had, and so that obviously will be in March and then the first weekend in April on ESPN and ABC. So make sure to check that out.
Ryan, feel better, and appreciate you coming on.
Thanks a lot, Taylor. Appreciate you, man. In the car, and I put that on my mama. Got my bitch called, talking about some drama. I swear there ain't no time for women on a comma. They see the pussy or the comma. Man, I just wanna go flex. Bored on my teeth and on my neck. And I'm stone cold with the flex. With the squad, and I'm smoking up a check. Man, I just wanna go flex. Bored on my teeth and on my neck. And I just wanna go flex, go on my
starting to excite me. She's sending all her friends snaps on my new tracks, cause all these hoes know what's about to come next. I hit my plug up, got the paper connect. I drop a couple bands, I just wanna go. Man, I just wanna go flex.